This is The Conversation. It's episode 192 with Rebecca Morgan. She is a Clearfield, Pennsylvania-based artist and educator. That's right, Clearfield, the heart of Pennsylvania. And you might be saying, WTF is that? We talk about it. Don't worry, we'll get there. Relates to her work as well. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can, check out quite a potpourri of images from Rebecca. She gave me a ton to use. I could only fit in so many, but go check those out, especially if you don't know her work and fans of hers. Feel free to check out ones that you may not have seen. There's a lot of local color, both literally and figuratively, and so much more. I think you'll enjoy perusing them. Yeah, we'll talk about the sensibility. I'm not going to blow the cover just yet, but just go check them out. There's one in particular, which is called Cinnabon in Bed, which is something we talk about, which is quite an image, but there's so many more. Also, while you're at theconversationpod.com, you can donate to the show. It's been a while since we've got a donation. But thank you very much to Kieran, longtime listener and supporter of the show, for joining on Patreon recently. Thank you very much. I will talk more about that on the back end, but you can donate to the show via PayPal or become a regular supporter on Patreon through the website. You can also find past episodes, and you can connect with the show and me if you like. Yeah, this is a long one. It hopefully will satisfy your fix for the next couple of weeks, since we've just moved to once every other week on the show, as you may have heard me talk about before. Stay tuned for everything under the sun in an episode, including a dating profile and my playing a little matchmaker or attempting to. So for you single men out there, whether you live in Pennsylvania or in the Ohio, Cincinnati in particular area, do stay tuned for an interesting PSA of sorts. All right, before we jump into that, wanted to give you a heads up that on the back end, I will talk about Robert Rauschenberg, since he has a retrospective and was written about in my favorite art columnist's column. So I wanted to refer to that, which refers back to a brief exchange earlier on this podcast. And before finally we get into the Rebecca Morgan episode, I wanted to give you a brief update on Focus Group, the show that I have been touting for about a month now, which finally opened a couple of weeks ago. The show I curated at Charlie James Gallery here in Los Angeles. It's called Focus Group, 7 artists. Other than just giving the details of the show itself, which I've done before, I wanted to tell you about the opening, which happened on May 20th. We could certainly make it into a pity party or what have you. That's not my intention. I realized that over 5.5 years doing the show that there's been no talk, there's been no conversation about what it's like at your own opening. I mean, maybe a smidgen of a conversation about it with Jennifer Dalton, but other than that, but we barely scratched the surface at all. So I thought I would be the guinea pig in talking about what it's like your own opening. Now, this is, granted, curating a show and being at the opening is not exactly the equivalent to at all of having your own work up and being at your opening. And maybe I can start talking with artists on the show about that, but it is still a big deal, and it is this sort of social culmination of quite a bit of work, not necessarily as much in this case curating for me as showing work is, but all that to say that the opening turnout wise was a disappointment, honestly. I'm gonna put that out there, and without pointing fingers or anything along those lines, I do want to thank people, by the way, who came, and people who told me that they could not come. So you guys are certainly all good. There are a lot of people who just, as you know from having had openings yourself or been to openings, that, you just don't hear from them, you don't see them. What I want to more specifically, though, describe is this anticipation element of it, which I'm sure most of you can identify with in one way or another. And that is that, so here's my strategy. Low expectations, right? I mean, what do you have to lose when you have low expectations? You know, that expression, hope for the best, expect the worst, hope for the best, whatever order that's in. That's just being realistic, you know, because if you go, oh, there's going to be, it's going to be so great. There are going to be tons of people. It's going to be a mob scene, yada, yada, however you dream up, fantasize in your head, you know, that's all going to come crashing down in one way or another. But if you go in, you know, not that many people are going to come, or however you think about it, however you cogitate in the lead up to the show. So that's basically what my intention was. And then, like, within the last week or so, with a little assist from Charlie James himself, who said, you excited, man? It's going to be great. You know, you have a big following, yada, yada. And I let in that little leak of air that blew up my expectations. And yeah, so it was okay. But let's put it this way. I'm glad it's over. No more lead up to worry about and anticipate. And, you know, I wasn't nervous per se, but I was definitely, you know, juggling some anticipation emotions. So that is over. That is good. The show is good. If you are in Los Angeles and you haven't seen it, please do go check it out and let me know what you think. That's another thing about having openings. These days, you kind of never really know what people think, because as great as it is to get great feedback, it's as bad to get really bad feedback. And so people tend to ride that middle point where they don't really tell you anything other than, oh, great job. Great job. Did an awesome job. or as Homestar Runner would say, you did a great jorp, for those of you who remember that. All right. Would love to hear your opening experiences. Feel free to shoot me a note. Participate. We're working on, by the way, some kind of premium for you guys to encourage you to donate to the show. So that's in the works, just FYI. Without further ado, let's get into that conversation with Rebecca. Thank you guys very much for being here. Stick around for a brief back end, Robert Rauschenberg and more. All right. Talk to you on the back end. Well, why don't we start with where you are? Because that's a pretty interesting element to our context, right?
Yeah. I'm living and working in my childhood home and hometown in Clearfield, Pennsylvania, which is like central Pennsylvania.
Right.
And it's kind of like been my home base in terms of, you know, if I'll take a year off to maybe work on a show, which is what I did last. This is, you know, the last year that I've been here. And it's always kind of like this intermediate zone that I always come back to in between, like, teaching gigs. You know, I teach a lot and bounce around. And so I find myself coming back here, and it's kind of been the source of inspiration and comfort. And yet it's really conservative and backwards, and it's super isolating. I'm completely by myself all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I have my family here. I live with my mom still. Mm-hmm. And so that's really, family's really important to me.
What about the rest of your family? Siblings, father?
Yeah. So my mom, she was a school teacher for 35 years. And then my dad, he had cancer when I was 10, and he died. So it's really just been my mom and my younger brother, who's kind of like this golden boy, mm-hmm. jocular physical therapist. And so I'm kind of this black sheep artist, but very embraced. But it was really my mom who raised my brother and I, and we had a really awesome kind of idyllic childhood in the country. And we were always around family, and that was a big, big part, and it still is a big part of my life.
So, is where you are considered the country? It's Clearfield, did you say, is the town?
Yeah, Clearfield, Pennsylvania.
Clearfield. Totally. So Clearfield is considered rural / country, even.
Yeah, big time.
Got it.
I mean, when I say like in the middle of nowhere, I'm really, truly in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
Like,
right.
Right off of Interstate 80, and super central. The closest town that I have is Penn State, which is 45 minutes away.
Right.
And really, that's it. I mean, we don't have it's really, really isolating here.
Yeah.
There's a few little shops. It's a dying coal town, like a dying farm town.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, economically really distressed for sure.
So the big picture here for me is, and this goes to your work as well, because as your fans will know, you know, you depict some kind of amalgamation of the country hick mixed with whatever, you know, fill in the blank. But the question is, have you sort of vacillated between, you know, being isolated and being sort of in the middle of things? And maybe even a more important question is, at what point, even though you're still there kind of as a temporary home base now, when did you sort of get out or get away from that culture? Or is it this kind of dynamic where you're living in this place that's dead, but you're spiritually not there? You know what I mean? How would you like to put it?
Yeah, and I get asked this all the time, and it's like very fascinating. And it's fascinating for me, too, in the sense that it's both a place that I deeply love and that I completely reject. Like, it's always in
right.
this liminal space of, like, loving
good word.
And loathing. And that's, what's that?
I just said good word, liminal.
Yeah, and that's one that comes up all the time, liminal, in the sense that,
yeah.
you know, it's either not really here, not really there. When I'm in the country, I want to go to the city. And I drive to New York probably once a month at this point, usually, and it's 4 hours away.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's just like this constant discomfort of, you know, I feel like a total outsider here. And then I felt, you know, when I went to graduate school at Pratt, and that's kind of like the big outbreak moment, which I'll get to.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
that was kind of like the moment where I still felt like a bumpkin in the city. And so
mm-hmm.
I was going back and forth, and it's always, the work comes out of this, but it's kind of like a place that I like to put it has rejected me. There's no place for me here. There's no
right.
place for me to be an artist or do anything, but it's very charming. I had an idyllic life here, and I still do, but
mm-hmm.
you know, in the sense that it can support me as an artist, absolutely not. And it can't support regular people with jobs. And there's just no hope in this cyclical kind of behavior. And so it's that kind of sense that it's more a place that I come back to all the time
right.
in the sense that it's, you know, it's definitely like home, but it's the sense that it rejected me and charmed me at the same time.
Right.
And so,
right. Yeah.
And then it's very strange in the sense that, you know, home is always home, but, God, it's so depressing in the sense that I wish it could be something, you know, we used to have a lot of independent stores and it was a real thriving little small town Americana. And it's just like,
mm-hmm.
so depressingly downturned, and I just can't imagine it coming back, and everyone's really conservative and awful, and so I kind of keep that I'm like an artist on the down low, and so I think these people that I kind of see that I'm surrounded by, and they're kind of like they're very close to the painting sometimes, and so they're like family, friends, people that I grew up with, but at the same time I feel very aware that I'm painting them from kind of like this privileged position of, you
right,
know,
right.
being an artist and using them kind of as fodder. But, you know, it's still always the discussion about, you know, I totally identify as an Appalachian American to whatever degree that is, or, you know, as this rural individual, because I feel like I have this liminal position of seeing both sides of things.
What I wanted to get to your peers as in Clearfield. Did the people that you go to school with, you know, like throughout school or high school or whatever, are they all gone? Are some of them still around?
No, it's really just me.
Wow.
Totally me. And that's the other thing. There's no youth or there's no reason for anyone to stay.
Right.
And so,
right.
It's so desolate and like a one stoplight town that there's no reason why anyone would want to raise a family here. And I'm completely depressed over that. But in a sense, it's just like, you know, this is kind of just like a way station for me, a halfway point to whatever the hell I'm doing, which half the time I don't even ever know.
Yeah.
until, you know, spring comes around, application season comes up, and that kind of shit. And so, but yeah, there's nobody, no one here. It's really just me and my family, and it's the same thing every single day. I wake up, do the same shit, see the same people or lack thereof, but the thing is that it really affords me nothing but time and space to work. I mean, my studio is literally my old childhood bedroom, and that, you know, my mom helped clear out, and I just sit here and make things and listen to stupid shit on the internet and
what's your
every single day.
What's your bedroom, Rebecca, while your old bedroom is your studio? What is your now bedroom in the house?
Oh, I sleep in my brother's bedroom. And it's just tiny. And I pretty much have all my things in storage or downstairs in the basement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've moved around so many times. And so all my stuff is just, and that's the other thing that, you know, gives me a lot of discomfort in the sense that, you know, place is really a huge part of my work, and it's always diaristic. But, you know, at this time, it's such a bizarro moment in the sense that I'm in my home, which is the general place. But then at the same time, it's just like, you know, I'm living in my brother's bedroom, and I have all my shit downstairs, and I don't really have, you know, it's still my home, but it's definitely not my home. It's
right.
Not my place. And so that's, it feels like suspended adolescence in a lot
right.
of ways. And so,
well, on a practical, let me interject. So on a practical level, since you describe this desolate town and presumably financially on the down, how difficult would it be, just out of curiosity, for you to rent, if not like an actual studio, a garage or whatever, since the rent presumably is pretty low?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have definitely looked in that. When I first came back home off and on, I was like, this is going to be cake. I'm going to live like a queen. I'm
right.
going to have this ridiculous, cool studio. And I was, you know, looking around, and I was completely shocked. There's this kind of sense of there's definitely this anti-intellectual thing that happens across rural America. And I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but, you know, when I would ask these people, you know, I'm thinking about having a studio, and they're like, well, what kind of studio? I'm an art studio. And they'd be like, oh, you know, I'm not really sure, would you, you know, what that even entails. And so there's a sense that they're just like, oh shit, I don't understand that. I don't even know. And so
mm-hmm.
there's a lot, like, people wouldn't kind of take a chance on me. And in a lot of ways, there's a ton of places, but you'd be so shocked, and I'm continuously shocked that I can't find a place that I could, you know, contribute to this town for less than, you know, it's like still Brooklyn prices. And
really?
You know, people think that they're, that their real estate is worth way more than it is.
Wow.
Like, we have all these awesome empty storefronts downtown, and it's just like, you know, for $1,000 a month, you could have this. And it's just like, this crazy shit. And I think about all the cool things I could do with my community having an art studio. But at the same time, it's just like, I can't do that. And so it's this kind of heartbreaking cyclical thing over and over again that, you know, I would love to have that be a dialogue in my town, but it just doesn't seem like it's feasible. And so I'm really keeping my costs low by
right
by
yeah I totally
being at home
I,
and just
I yeah
what
I totally get the keeping the costs low. I mean, that I could totally see that side of it. I just wonder, and you know, maybe this is more of a longer term scenario, but I just feel like, and I could be deluding you and me, but that there's like some rogue character, you know, in your little hick town or whatever you want to call it, that would be sympathetic and, like, you know, would be the key to you getting you that commercial space that you could then begin building the art community of Clearfield with, right?
Yeah, I think that rogue character would probably be me.
So you need to buy a building, in other words, right?
Yeah, you would think, like, there's so many opportunities like that. I mean, crazy Victorian houses for, like, you know, $200,000 that I look at and I'm like, there's a residency that I could, like, just immediately have, you know, or these massive old, you know, industrial buildings that I look at and I'm like, Christ, that is a residency that I can have tomorrow. And but it's still just like, you know, is that a life that I want to have? You know, still like that's a permanent rural kind of lifestyle, and really married to this thing. And so it's back and forth between this kind of project and like being selfish, kind of being like this, you know, independent artist and just wanting to do my own shit and not having to worry too much about it. So I go back and forth again all the time. And it's a lot of, you know, I get the feeling from my hometown that the people wouldn't really want that or can actually participate in it because no one has any money or expendable income anyways to even, you know, take art lessons or, you know, be involved or buy, you know, $200 worth of materials and shit like that. So mm-hmm. It's all kind of feeds into another in that sense that people can't really participate and they're really not sure. And I don't really know if it's one of those heartbreaking things that I want so deeply for my town to be a thing or to at least be survivable or to at least have a simple life, but it doesn't seem like that is ever going to happen despite a lot of efforts in the past. And so
Yeah. It's
kind of now this feeling of, I guess I'm just going to let it simmer out, you know, mm-hmm. And sadly it feels like that.
Yeah. It seems like you would on a practical level need to really become financially solvent, you know, bring in a big bank load to be able to take on the control of, you know, of building up a community there with an artistic bent, you know, because that's something that based on what you're describing with your current lifestyle, you know, I mean, that's gotta be somewhere down the road. And I get sticking around for the low cost before you move on to the next gig or show or whatever. But it seems like this is sort of one of the subtexts you're describing, and you did talk about the, you know, the heartbreak of it, though, is that you know, as soon as you have the chance, you're going to get away because it's kind of like too painful to deal with being there and not being able to do anything. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. And it's at this, you know, I've kind of had these, like you said, these plans for, you know, making it work here, and now I've just realized over and over again, and a lot of it has come out of just the election, and you know, really all this bad shit conservative percolating out of this town, and I'm just like, I don't think I just can't cope anymore. And although it's not something that, you know, I bring up or talk to people about, because everyone, you know, around here, I'm not going to change anyone's minds. And that's the other thing that I've realized. I'm not going to change people's, you know, whole lifestyles or thoughts that they've held on for years. I have like the conversation with people from New York a lot of times. Well, why can't you, you know, help these people understand, you know, what's really going on in the world? I'm like, well, these people have, it's just how ingrained so deeply. And, you know, it's just very clear that I'm not going to change anything. And that's a very frustrating, that's the epicenter of the heartbreak. And it's just mm-hmm. like, so now I kind of feel like maybe I had a good shot at it, or maybe I had tried to have some dialogues and I just kind of kept my nose to the ground more or less. And now I'm realizing I've had a good run. I think I'm definitely getting out, but it's always probably going to be this space that I always return to just because it's home and family, and I always have a spot here, and it's completely free for me. But at the same time, I feel like I'm losing a lot of my sanity and doing the exact same thing with such limited resources over and over again. But at the same time, it's, you know, how it's kind of just been a residency for a year of just been doing, you know, whatever I want, mm-hmm. and that's not something that many people are able to do. So I'm super thankful to be able to do that, but it definitely comes at a cost. But I definitely probably have more fun here than what I'm alluding to, just in the sense of, you know, hanging out and doing nothing. Like those types of things are really appealing to me.
Right.
So I do make it sound awful, but it is you know, I spend all day long just ruminating on shit and right. thinking about stuff. And so that's where a lot of it comes
out. Well, do you, let me distinguish, because that's a very important word. Do you maybe mean pondering? Because ruminating tends to mean more second guessing, you know, thinking about things that I shouldn't have done, or thinking about people that I'm enemies with, or, you know what I mean? It's more,
yeah,
so it's more of a pondering,
a
or is it
that.
Both? There's both. Okay. Got it.
Yeah, for sure. The basic tendril that I have to the art world and to the world at large is just the internet and my phone. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I'll make some things or I'll check Instagram all day long or Facebook all day long, read the news all day long. And it's just peppered throughout me making things or whatever mm-hmm. I'm doing mm-hmm. Because there isn't anything else for me to do. And that is my only source. And so there is a lot of just like, oh, look at this ding dong making this stupid shit again. Here we go. And so there's a lot of, you know, just like looking at that and just being like, oh, and feeling so far from the art world, but also just like not like, thank God I'm far from the art world right now. Thank God I'm in the country just doing my thing.
Right.
And so there is definitely that feeling. But there's, I think with probably all artists, it's the sense of, you know, I'm just exhaustively thinking and sponging things. And, you know, I watch TV a lot, and I think about television and humanity in a greater sense as like kind of this reflective thing. And so I'm always like thinking about how can I use this, or what is this, or and so that's the kind of thing that never stops. And there's definitely the shitty, like, negative ruminating, too, of,
right.
like, brooding,
right,
pained
right, brooding.
Artist
yes.
Stereotypes that
yes.
goes on, for sure.
Well, let's go extracurricular for a second here, because as you just started to talk about that you enjoy your time there, and you know you're hanging out, you know you're doing all the social media stuff, you're watching TV, you're reading the news, and so on. Right before you started talking about that, I was thinking, because we were talking about where you were, you know, and how shitty it is mm-hmm. as far as the political climate and so on. I was thinking, what is your romantic life like? Now, I know the options there are presumably very limited, but I still couldn't help but wonder, like, well, what if you did, you know, Tinder for, you know, where Penn State is, or, you know, something like that?
Yeah. This was coming up somehow.
Okay, so we're
so
here.
Much to talk and so much to speak on.
Good.
Yeah, I have, for sure. When I first got here, you know, and this isn't the first year that I've spent here. I've spent, you know, probably 2 years ago, I was here for a year and a half and that kind of thing. And
mm-hmm.
and during that time, I was constantly on the internet trying to I would be looking at people on like OkCupid and Tinder and all that shit, and
right.
I would be driving to New York for dates because I was like, there's no one I will ever find in the middle of nowhere,
right.
And trust me, it's exactly what you would think in terms of dating people. They kind of look like my paintings, and
right.
I go
right.
like up in an awful way, but like it's so brutal here. And so I was going to New York and dating, you know, all these art dudes, and
mm-hmm.
or sometimes not, and that was so brutal. And I think the dating climate has changed. Obviously, there's so much how people have talked about this, in the sense that now we have our phones, and we're connected in this weird culture that way, and how people are kind of disposable, and we move on, and ghost, and it is so
true. Can I jump in? Can I jump
so
in for
brutal.
A second, Rebecca?
Yeah.
So this is really timely, because among the TV shows that you're watching, are you watching Masters of None by any chance?
Oh Christ! Totally.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay. Okay.
Time.
So we just watched the episode last night called First Date. Have you seen that one yet?
Yeah.
Okay. So
I have. Yeah,
when you
he goes
so
on all the yeah.
so when you said it's when you, so when you started talking about going driving to New York and going on all these dates with these art dudes, and then you said it's been brutal, I totally went to that that whole sequence of dates that he went on. And for people listening, just to like give it a very quick caption description, he goes on all these Tinder dates, and it's a whole range from having sex on the first date to these women who, you know, are going on Tinder while they're on the date with him to, right?
Yeah.
And to other sort of nightmares of, you know, how bad a date can be. So can you give us an example or two of maybe some of your first dates?
Oh, God. I mean, I've been on a lot of, I'm exhaustively looking for a partner in a lot of ways. Just like, I'm very much attached to the sense of like, I have my own family, because family is like the most important thing for me. And so, and like this idyllic life. And so, and I'm trying to, this kind of pastoral thing that I'm chasing. And I've been just realizing that that no dudes in the city want that. Like, no one wants to come move to the country with me. Or, you know, it's most of my dates like that have been just use and abuse, you know, wine and dine, and then peace out, never to be heard of again. Or when I do, it's a lot of just such horrible bad behavior, like fragile male ego thing that I see over and over again. And it's not always art dudes, but the ones that I have like been back and forth with, it's just this exhaustive, competitive thing in terms of, you know, a lot of people that are artists, both male and female, just said how it's really difficult in terms of success. If one person is successful, the other one's kind of upset, and that definitely happens. I can't even articulate the horrible things that people that have happened. More or less, it's just been this kind of toying, cat and mouse. I love you 1 second and then never to be heard of. It's a lot of ghosting and just telling you what you want to hear, and disgusting behavior like that of like stringing along. And I fall for it hook, line, and sinker every time. I'm just like, oh yeah, you know, he's telling me everything I want to hear, and then nothing. And it's just a horrible behavior over and over again.
I'm so sorry.
So I was doing that for a really long time, and then, and just working so hard at it. But,
ask you about that. Do you think that it is a generational, like, you know, late millennial thing? Do you think it's an artist thing? Do you think it's just where we are now, regardless of generation, as far as date behavior?
That's a good question. I really think that it has a lot to do with generational kind of scenario. And I've kind of given up on a lot of New York scenario. I just kind of always thought that it was New York. That's the thing. That's where all my mates are going to be. I mean, with a 4-hour radius between Philadelphia and New York, 3 hours to Pittsburgh. I tried dating in Pittsburgh. It was more of the same. But it's more so just that, I think there's so much to be said in terms of, and I'm the same, you know, instant gratification. There's so much all the time, especially for guys in New York. There are so many girls, and there's so, you know, I think it's disproportionate. And I think that guys are more or less really used to getting what they want and expending females just in horrible ways in that sense. And I think that it is much more nonchalant, and that's just kind of not how I'm wired. And so there's like a little bit of both things going on, and that I think that it's a cultural thing for sure. And I'm probably guilty of that in a lot of most ways for sure. But I think that there's definitely that sense of a little bit of entitlement, and I don't know, maybe I've just been around so many gross dudes that I feel so jaded, but yeah, there's definitely a lot of that.
I feel like I want to play matchmaker for you. How do you feel about that?
Anyone listening, send me a DM. I swear to God, like, I am open to anything. If you have someone, Michael, like, I'm all ears for it. Trust me.
What are your geographical limitations, would you say?
I am so good with anything. I really am. I've done long distance relationships forever, and mm-hmm. I'm really good at them. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I'm used to that just because
are
I
you
live
in one
so
now?
Far away.
Are you in one now? A long distance?
I'm getting out of one. No, I actually was dating someone from town, from Clearfield, for a year, which I never thought would ever happen to me.
Wow, the one liberal in Clearfield?
Yeah. What?
I said the one liberal in Clearfield.
Literally, figuratively, you're right on with that.
Wow.
We like somehow found each other.
Wow.
That I had no idea even existed. But
so
I was doing long distance relationships forever, and but it's hard because I bounce around so often, and
right.
so
right.
you know, so many people are just like, oh, we'll have a good time in New York, or there are a lot of people that I could imagine myself being with in New York, but then it's just like, you know, are they going to come 4 hours to the middle of nowhere? And I've definitely had boyfriends that have done that. Yeah, it's always been hard. Dating's brutal no matter what. So, females, keep your chins up. It is brutal. I salute you. Keep fighting the good fight. Fuck the man. All that. It's just awful.
Well, wait a second. Not that I would know about how – I mean, I have a sense of how bad it is. But just, you know, as I briefly mentioned, you know, the quote-unquote fictional Aziz Ansari first date from that show – that's mm-hmm. a legitimate perspective from the male side. So, I mean, you have to have some sympathy for men going out into the dating world as well, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And that episode, it's and that whole show, honestly, about that's very, very accurate, I think, in terms of mm-hmm. of the dating world right contemporarily right now, for sure.
Right.
I think that's a really good slice of how it is. And I know that there are most of the guys that I entertain are definitely more on the track of seriousness. But it's like a lot of weeding out to get to do that. And
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
I think that it's hard for both. I don't want to be, you know, I am definitely sensitive to the male plight, but I'm kind of not at the same time. I'm just kind of like, I feel in a lot of ways that they've got it a little bit easier. And this is a whole can of worms I feel like I'll probably get into, but it's just kind of like, you know, on a daily basis, if you saw the messages that I get from people on the internet on OkCupid or shit like that, you would be, I mean, it's astonishing. It's just, hey girl, hey, how are you? Beautiful eyes, you know, just, I mean, I probably get 30 a day.
Wow.
And it's just exhaustive. And those are the nice ones. You know, those are the ones that aren't like, hey, I have a foot fetish. Let me take you shopping. You know, and I love those. I love reading those because they're ridiculous.
Right.
But it's just, I mean, it's incessantly, it's exhaustive. And so
yeah.
Females for sure have it harder, no doubt. This is where I always get the hate on my Instagram page when I'm just like, but it is. It's brutal either way. It really
okay.
is hard.
Yeah. And just
I don't know what to do.
And just,
just find me someone. That's all I
have. We're working on it. We're working on it as we speak. This episode will be the launching pad for that. But just to put a final...
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
you're,
you.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to put a final point on it, I think basically what... If we were to use one or two words to describe what your experience, and perhaps one could say for men in, you know, in the contemporary dating world, it would be playing games. Is that fair?
Yeah. And I don't know if it's always intentional. I think that it's probably just, I think that everyone has a lot on their plate, and sometimes it's all in earnest that, you know, don't get a text back, or, you know, or that just not up front, or that, but I think in my experience, there have been just mostly balancing a lot of other girls that are not me, you know, it's that kind of thing, or just bad behavior in that sense of just completely disappearing. And I like this social etiquette we now have, now that kind of thing is acceptable to just like, you know, now, as I said, ghosting, like that's a
yeah.
normal term that people
yeah.
are like, oh yeah, he just left, he just ghosted. And that's disturbing to me. And that's like, and that is just something like, oh, that's a normal thing now. That's so upsetting that
yeah.
that's like a normal way that we are now thinking of how to find mates. And really, the internet is the only way to do that. And so it's kind of this damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of scenario, in the sense of where else am I going to find people? I'm not going to sit at a bar, you know, but so it's that kind of thing. Now I'm just kind of, I'm pretty exhausted by all of it. So I'm just going to, as they say, do me for a little bit and make my stupid face jugs and just like not worry too much about it. Because it's really a full-time commitment, and I can't.
Well, let's.
So I'm just going to enjoy myself for a little bit.
So let's say, I think this is a good segue to, I mean, you've talked about the ambivalence about where you are, you know, and the career realities are sort of been implied, but just on a practical level, I mean, you have a teaching gig coming up, right? Is that for the fall?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's for the fall.
Yeah. So let's say beyond that teaching gig, what is, we haven't discussed the realities of or your personal limitations as far as settling in more of a, if not art capital like New York, just a bigger city where you would maybe have a situation where you would be seeing and meeting people in real life rather than just digitally. Is that, other than New York, which I assume, and you can certainly fill us in on, you know, that is basically, you know, way too expensive to maintain the kind of art-making lifestyle that you have. But what about, like, a Pittsburgh or somewhere in the Midwest or, you know, what have you? I mean, are those places that are ever on the table for you? Or what is your sort of slightly longer-term scenario as far as possibilities?
Yeah, that's, I mean, any of those places are for sure. I mean, anywhere it would be totally fine. I have visited so many places. I went to the Bemis Center in Omaha, Nebraska, and I loved Omaha. I was like, Omaha's the greatest place ever. Mm-hmm. You know, I can walk and get a cool tea. I can go have a, you know, walk down the street and read a book, you know, like to go to a bookstore. I can't even do that, you know, and we have like a grocery store that's like the things that fell off the back of the truck, like that, and Walmart, like that's what we, so like any place that has like, oh, a Starbucks, shit, that's cool. You know, like, I mean, I don't know how cool Starbucks is, but in the sense it's just like something. And so I entertain anything. And really my ideal scenario is, you know, I would love to just be in a place to settle in. And it's mostly tied to teaching, in the sense that that's always been my ultimate goal. That's always been what I always envisioned myself and what I always wanted, that kind of elusive tenure track kind of scenario. And so it's mostly wherever that is where I'm totally cool with. Like, I am good to go wherever that is. I'm a huge believer that it doesn't have to be New York City. I think that for a lot of people, it's just wrong. And it's a lot of time, effort, killing yourself for, you know, if you're trying to quote unquote make it, whatever that means as an artist, I mean, sure, I think it's very necessary to spend some time in New York or whatever, but I think that I get just as much done on Instagram and the internet and sending messages and following up with people in social media rather, and then following it up once a month or twice a month, or, you know, whenever I get to New York in person. And that is very fruitful for me. And when I go to New York now, even for like the weekend, I'm just like, I don't know how anyone does it. I don't know how I did it for so long. It's so overwhelming, exhaustive, expensive. And I would be anywhere where I can settle in and contribute and have like an awesome academic life. And so that's like, I'm going to, Cincinnati this fall for a year. And so couldn't be more thrilled about Cincinnati. Cincinnati looks freaking awesome and it is awesome. So, so I'm open to any of that kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah. So what is the situation with Cincinnati as far as it's basically a 1-year contract? Is there a potential for, you know, getting renewed or anything like that? Or does that remain to be seen?
I guess it remains to be seen. It's always, with all these things, it's always kind of the first thing that people kind of throw, like, oh, well, we, you know, hopefully maybe we'll see where we are at the end of the year. In my old gigs, that's kind of how it always was. Or, but, you know, this is a one-year teaching appointment. I've been to Cincinnati before with my really good friends who I actually met at the Bema Center, and they run the ceramics department, Mike and Key. And they are rock stars, and so they've kind of pulled me in. They needed someone for some drawing classes, and I didn't have anything. I was looking for something. I was up for another gig, and that kind of fell through, and so I've just been, so I'm really thankful. I'm super excited to go out there, but it's always kind of the, you know, maybe with a hope and a wish that maybe it'll be long term, but it's always, I mean, for the past however many years, probably, I don't know, 7, 8 years, it's just been, you know, constantly, you know, when spring comes around with application season, you know, jobs are being posted, and it's always, you know, I'll apply to, like, countless. I think I probably applied to 10, 15, 20 schools just this spring. And so it's always just like, you know, what's going to take, what's going to happen. It's, and that's kind of ultimately what I'm tired of, this kind of unknown kind of thing. And, you know, kind of coming back to place is very important, and home, whatever home is very important. And I've been kind of working without my sense of place for a really long time. And so it's really, whatever that place will be, is I'm dying to get there, essentially.
Right.
Like to
right.
settle into a place.
Yeah.
That's my own.
Sure. So tell me, I think we need to, you mentioned it as far as your, well, actually, before we get to Instagram, that's basically where I'm leading to. We will get there. You did mention that, well, you do have a gallery that's in New York, and I presume you spent, I think you mentioned when we spoke before, you spent 6 years there, is that right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So to what extent is your current gallery representation related to the time that you did spend there versus happening after you left?
Well, I guess more or less the story is that when I was living in New York, I went straight from undergrad straight to grad school. So I was really little. I was young. I think when I graduated, I was 22. And so I had no work experience or anything. So I was just hanging out in New York, and I couldn't get a job. And so I was interning a lot and working for free. I don't know if this is where the question was leading you, but I guess this is where I'm taking you.
That's fine.
But so I was working for free with a lot of places, and you know, I had no work experience. I was a child, essentially. And so the thing I decided to do, I was just going to intern and make that my job, and I wasn't getting paid or anything. And I stumbled upon this one scenario where I was working kind of like as a gallerina artist assistant, and she was doing a lot of backroom dealing for, you know, clients and things. And one of her paintings fell through for a client, and she needed this was not my gallery that I'm currently at, but the one I started at. She needed someone to basically fill the spot for a client. And so she was looking, and she's like, show me everyone that you know, I need to find someone. And so I showed her all these people I knew from school, everyone else. And then finally she was like, what do you do? You're an artist. And so I showed her my work, and she was opening up her gallery again. And so I was like the second show that she had. And that was like my first show ever in New York. And it just happened from basically not like entering for free, killing myself. It was,
right.
You know, stupid. But so I did that. And essentially my current gallery, Aussie Geisberg, picked me up from that. She saw, and I jumped ship because it was kind of a shit show. But yeah. And so I've been with her for a really long time, and I have for probably 6 years at this point with Aussie, and I love her, but I was living in New York and didn't have anything else to do but work for free.
Right.
So in a lot of ways, that's kind of how this happened. But is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah. That's
the story I told you.
No, you just actually made the full route from being in New York to getting gallery representation. Exactly. So yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
And so, just on a practical level, as far as income, sales, mm-hmm. your work definitely is marketable, saleable. What is it? Where's the gap? I guess I'm trying to put this delicately, and I think I'm already doing a bad job. But what is the what is the objective, or what is your bottom line from sales with your gallery to be able to make a living from your work? And I guess the sort of follow up question to that is. An assumption on my part is that you maybe don't want to depend on that, and so the teaching thing is still going to be a reality regardless.
Yeah, it's always going to be a reality mm-hmm. in the sense that that's like how I would eat, how I survive, how I, you know, have, you know, buy a house, that kind of stuff. You know, my art right now it's very, very good supplementally. Mm-hmm, and in a pinch, it would be a horrible life, but I could probably live on it. But I'm very lucky in the sense that it has never been the main directive of me living my life, or that it's never been, you know, I have to sell a painting this month or I don't eat.
Right.
So it's definitely, I've never looked at it that way. And I've always had to do other things, or, you know, when I was in New York, I was just doing stupid odd jobs. I was art handling, like just from mouth, you know, word of mouth from person to person, or I would paint gallery walls, or I would, you know, clean out people's studios. I would do anything like mm-hmm. that, and mm-hmm. for nothing, for like a few hundred dollars. And so, so there was that type of thing. And so now, like I said, I'm very interested in this at this point, not killing myself for, you know, to make a living. So here I am. So here I am in the country. Here I am in the middle of nowhere, because it has afforded me time and space to just exist. You know, I don't pay rent here. I don't, you know, it's just my house, my mom's house with my mom. And so, like I said, at the same time, that's a trade-off, but it's never been driven in that way. I'm more or less chasing the academic, mm-hmm. Tenure track crazy thing, which is, you know, what in some ways almost harder to do than get a gallery to represent you.
Sure.
But my main focus forever, the only thing I ever wanted was stability in being stabled at a gallery that I really love and respected, and to be a professor. And so I was able to do that relatively early. And that was one of the, I don't think I would have left, I'll be completely honest, I don't think that I would have left New York if I didn't have a gallery that represented me, that
right.
gave me that kind of stability or mm-hmm. Security more so.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether I sell a million things or not, it's always just the fact that I'm showing work and that kind of thing. And I definitely do well. I do better when there's a show up, when there's work on the walls, but it's not something that sales are not something that I am consumed with.
So you've been showing there.
It sounds kind of like I'm kind of like a prima donna, preachy. I know that I'm very privileged in the sense that I have the security, but like I said, I don't think I would have left if I didn't.
Yeah, no,
have that.
Right, I got that. So I was just going to ask you, you've been showing there for roughly 6 years, you said. How have the sales been over the years? You know, because with a lot of artists, I think the assumption or the understanding is that, you know, some years are good, some years are not so good, you know, kind of partially in line with where the economy is. But, you know, so what is that mm-hmm. trajectory been like?
Well, I'm consistently shocked that people even buy artwork. If I hadn't seen it with my own eyes or been to art fairs or any of that stuff, it's still like beyond me that, you know, people actually, that's something that people do, because it's almost so far from, it's such a weird balance in the sense that I make this and I'm involved in the art world, but from the opposite side of not the people buying it. And, you know, I love going to art fairs. I love having shows and that type of thing and dealing with collectors. And, you know, I know that that goes on, but it's almost just like, it's so bizarro. But yeah, like I said, things are always easier when I think that it's easier when there's a show, up. But I've been lucky enough that I've got a lot of collectors that are interested in, a lot of people that are interested in my work that are fans of ceramics, contemporary ceramics, or young female artists. There's a lot of collectors in that sense, and there's a lot of people that love the grotesque and so, or like love that type of kind of funny grotesque thing. So it's kind of, I pull from those types of people, but I think that it's been consistent. I think that it gets better. I mean, I hope to keep the same. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. This is the same amount of income every time. You know, I would be a little bit more concerned if, you know, in the next 3 years, it's just like, oh shit, this is really bad in comparison to the last few years. But it's mostly because I've had, you know, a show up, or we go to Miami once in a while, or that type of thing. So it's always contingent upon a million other factors. I mean, the election period just like crunched a lot of the show up, you know, and I think after the election or right during that time, or, you know, it sucked. So I don't know. It's always in flux. It's always the next new thing. I don't even understand it. And half the time, that's what I'm trying to articulate, that, you know, all I want to do is just make the stuff and then drive it to New York or pack it up. And I'm very privileged in the sense that I have someone to kind of help me do that, you know, and that I trust and love. And so I know that that's a very privileged position to be in. But that's what I worked really hard to get in the first place, because I knew that would be almost too hard for me to do by myself, if mm-hmm. that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It seems like, though, I mean, other than you're mentioning the around the election, that things, or after the election, I should say, things shut down perhaps because of a lot of collectors, disheartening state, but that your work has and does sell pretty consistently. So correct me if I'm wrong. So when you said earlier that the possibility of surviving on your work would be a horrible life, I think you said, or something to that effect, that seems a little underestimating. I mean, is your yearly income on average, without, you know, getting explicit unless you want to, not significant enough to survive on?
Probably not the kind of life that I like. I mean,
well, you're living in your mom's house right now. What does that mean?
Well, let me tell you, Pratt Institute was $100,000 to go to, more or less.
Jesus.
So right off the bat, like,
right.
Done.
Right.
You know, health insurance, done. Car payment, done. You know, it's
right.
Just like, I can still live in the middle of nowhere, but Jesus, you know, it's, I've got a lot of shit that happens. So it's definitely that. And like, yeah, once in a while, like, I like to go buy a Chanel lipstick and feel like I'm fancy, you know? So uh-huh. It's like once in a while, I like to do that type of thing.
Right. Right.
And so just to feel like a human,
right.
More or less. But,
right.
Yeah, I don't think that to live off of my art at this point, yeah, I could if I had to, but it is certainly not, you know, with everything, pretty much going to Pratt Institute, that did it. But I made a very, very clear choice. I knew when I went to, you know, when I was signing up for graduate school, I had a choice between other schools that probably would have paid me to go there, and I would be completely debt free. But I never thought I would live in New York. I never thought that that was ever something that I could do. And that was like such a dream. Mm-hmm. And it changed my life. And so that was like, that was what I did. And I would never regret it. Because that's being in New York and going to Pratt Institute was like, that's what, why I am. I think that's the center of how I got here, for sure. I don't think I would have ever gone to New York if I would have gone to school in Ohio or, you know, at Mass Art, I would have never come here. And right. So at the same, it's always like that, again, that liminal thing of, you know, and that brooding thing that I think about all the time, the trajectory and how you navigate things. And so, it was for sure something that changed my life. But at the same time, it's just like, yeah, Christ, that is, it's stupid to pay that much money to go to graduate school or to be an artist. But, you know, I knew I was able to. I, you know, cashed in all my bonds from when I was an infant, you know, and it's just like, all right, this is what I'm going to do. So I did it, and I would never regret it. But at the same, but yeah, I don't.
Were there any schools on the table that were, if not, you know, regular state tuition, at least not quite as costly as Pratt was in New York?
I think I applied to 10 schools, and I got waitlisted at Carnegie Mellon, and I got into Mass Art, and I, what was the other one? Oh, and Ohio University. And I was all ready to go to Ohio University because I was like, this is just what I'm going to do, you know? And then I got a call from Pratt, but they were all, they would have given me money to go there. And I would have had a TA, and I would have been set up to be a professor and the whole deal. But then it was like Pratt gave me the offer, and it was no money. You know, you don't get any scholarships to go there. You don't get anything. Right. And there's no teaching experience. It's just like, you're going to be a capital A artist. And that's all I wanted. And so I was like, this is it for me. And like I said, it changed my life, but, God, it's a little rough sometimes.
So how's the payoff of the tuition going?
Oh yeah. I would never regret it. I think everything that I learned about being an artist was from Pratt Institute. And a lot of it was just being in the city. And like I said, I was a child. I was 22 when I got there, and probably, I don't know, 23 or 24 when I got out. And so my idea of what, I didn't even know what a hipster was. I had no idea what any of that type of thing was. I thought the coolest girl ever, I watched Ghost World once, and I thought that like Enid was like, was the girl, you know? And so I never had any idea of this kind of cultural youth was out there. And so that was like a huge part of like a spring awakening for me. And so I learned more in my first week of going to Pratt about art and being an artist than I ever had in undergrad. I went to undergrad to be, you know, around here as a woman, you were either like a teacher, you were a nurse, you worked at the bank, you know, and so I never had any idea that I could go to art school or that was even something to do. So I went to undergrad to be a secondary English teacher to work in a high school. And then I realized that, you know, I didn't have to do that if I didn't want to, and started, you know, the trajectory to go to art school. But yeah, Pratt Institute was like the be and all. I learned everything about what it was to make a cohesive body of work, to how to make a show, everything. And so I would never, the payoff is, I would do it all over again in a heartbeat. I have no hesitation that wasn't the right decision for me. But, you know, there are a lot of people that I went to school with that, you know, their whole lives are going to be indebted to Pratt, and mine for sure, but I'm chipping away at it more or less.
Yeah.
And I think it's gross that's how it is, and I hope that it will change at some point. But, I don't know what the answer is to that, but graduate school, I think is, it changed my life. It's really important, if you want to be a working artist, to be able to talk about your work. That's where I learned everything, how to talk about it, how to go to an opening, what that meant, all that kind of shit.
What did they teach you about going to an opening?
Like you sign the book, you go and you, it's just kind of like the nuances of what you do. It's more or less of like, you should go to openings. You need to go and introduce yourself to people. You need to have discussions with people, or you should show up and you have to be scrappy. It was that kind of discussion that we had in terms of like, it's not just going to knock down your door or something, you know, someone's not just going to be like, let me give you a show. You have to put yourself out there. And so that's kind of a lot of what I had in the back of my mind when I couldn't get a job. And I was just like, well, I guess you have to be scrappy and go work for some galleries. And so I did that. And it totally, you know, that changed my life too, even though that was completely disgusting in a lot of ways. Like,
right.
Super gross.
Well, I'm sorry. I was just going to say we could get further into that, but maybe in a little bit. We should, before we get too far down into that hole, get to the thing we've been putting off, which is your social media, particularly your Instagram. So for those, I'm hoping that we're going to have a lot of your fans listening to this, but for those who are new, those who are new to you, you have over 22,000 followers, I just discovered, because I'm just on your page right now. And so so I want us to talk about things like how you got there, what your interactions are like, and strategies. I would really love to hear your take on what's become a successful strategy for you. So why don't we start with how you got there? I mean, has this been a particularly gradual thing where you got on Instagram quite a while ago, like towards the beginning, and have just slowly, gradually been building up? Have there been times when you had shows where your numbers advanced significantly? What's the answer to that question?
Really, I've been on it for probably maybe four or five years, but it was much more diaristic at the beginning, and it was at the beginning of Instagram where it was not really, you know, I was definitely not using it as a tool as much as I am now.
Right.
And but for the most part, it's really framed. I like to use it diaristically in the sense of, now more than ever, in the sense that my studio is, and the things that I make have kind of, they're all kind of the same in that sense. So I think it's important in the sense that I can be in the middle of nowhere and I can still be working in that sense and being connected in that sense. But really how I got followers, quote unquote, it sounds so stupid, how I gained followers was, I mean, it's really nothing more than I've been reposted a lot by people that have a lot of followers themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Like Juxtapose has been really helpful and a big proponent of my work. And so they'll share things if I have a show, or if I, you know, sometimes they'll just throw something up. And then, I mean, just from that, it's, you know, a few hundred immediately. Amy Sedaris, who I've had shows with, and she's a fan of my work, and she throws things up once in a while. And I mean, just from that,
sorry,
so
who
many
was that?
People. And so from those,
I'm sorry, who was that?
Amy Sedaris.
Oh, Amy Sedaris. So she. Oh, right. So I could see that. Is she particularly into the ceramics?
Yeah, we were in a group show once at Invisible Exports in New York, and we and she's been following my work and that kind of thing. And so just from that, I mean, it just takes one person. And just from her throwing that up, you know, a few times here and there, I get so many other followers. And then they will repost. And then they will, you know, so it just is organically, it happens in that sense. It's mostly been, most of my followers have come from her and from Juxtapose and, you know, just other things like, who's the Love Watts guy? He throws it up once a while, and it's like guaranteed a few hundred people. And so, yeah, when I have shows up, that you definitely, get more followers and that type of thing. But it's mostly just been driven by, you know, me making work and throwing it up and not really being too afraid of what happens or kind of how it's received. There are some things that happen that I have noticed, in the sense of, like, you know, if I throw up a picture of me and my family doing something, I can guarantee you I'll lose about 100 followers immediately.
Right.
So it's just like, so I've learned that type of thing.
Right.
But it doesn't stop me from, it's definitely curated, but it's not like, it's just whatever I want. It's just it's literally just like a slice of my life. And it's more or less like the underbelly of things. Like, for instance, last night, I spent all day making this huge jug, this ceramic face jug. And probably by the end of the night, literally hours, I worked on this stupid thing. And then it was thin and it wasn't working. And so finally I was like, I have to scrap it. But now how I think about things is just like, okay, how can I scrap this in a spectacular way and like show my frustration? And because I was so pissed, and just be like, all right, here, this is exactly what shit happens. And so here you go. Here's a picture of me like totally crunching my face jug. And so I don't do anything because it's just like, oh, this will get me mm-hmm. a lot of likes, or maybe it'll mm-hmm. be reposted. But it's mm-hmm. more just like, this is just what I'm doing. So,
right.
And people are genuinely interested. And so, and you know, art making is hard and it sucks. And so I like to show mm-hmm. just all the things that go into making something, because mm-hmm. It's not always a success. It's usually not a success.
And what is your strategy around frequency? I mean, is that something you consciously decide, or is it more, I have something to post, I'm going to post it kind of thing?
Yeah, it's definitely, if I'm a little conscious of it. I used to be like, okay, I would get on those apps that told me, mm-hmm. like, you should post at 3 p.m. because, but now it's just like, I don't have time for it. And it's also, I feel like I don't want to be a slave to it, but it's also, it's a huge part of how I, you know, make work and how people see my work.
Yeah.
And it is part of building, I don't want to say fans, but people that know and like my work.
But you do have fans.
But,
well, wait a second. Maybe it's a question of semantics, but I think you are, in some senses, a quintessential artist who translates really well to Instagram. And I think when you have that many followers and you're an artist, you have a fan base, you know? For people who are not familiar with you, you definitely come out of, and, you know, correct me if you feel like this is off at all, but you definitely come out of a certain degree of R. Crumb tradition, you know, and he certainly has an immense fan base, I would imagine. And so it's not surprising that, you know, that you have a fan base with, you know, your own version of that sort of sensibility, if you will.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. He makes a lot of sense, and I think about him all the time because he's like easily one of the highest gods in my pantheon, mm-hmm. and in the sense that he bounces back and forth between like high and low all the time. He, you know, he shows at David's Werner,
you know,
but is also on T-shirts and you know, does so. And he's a perfect example of just like showing the underbelly of things, which mm-hmm. I think is so important. And we don't see enough of, mm-hmm. you know, past the smoke and mirrors of stuff. He's just kind of like, I'm a self-professed creep and I'm going to show you the insides of my brain. And mm-hmm. so for me, that's how I really see it, in terms of a tool for, you know, just showing what's in my brain folds. But I think all the time, like, if some of my all-time favorite artists were using Instagram to show, and they do, a lot of people that I really love use Instagram, but if I think when I was in undergrad or if I was in graduate school, I would have just lived and breathed to see how my favorite artists were making their work, or what their lives were like, or what they're doing, or how they're navigating things, or what are they up to. And it's I think that it's definitely that slice of life, in the sense that it gives I think that it gives a little humanity to the things that we do. Or that I'm really inspired by transparency and showing the trajectory of point A to point B, or here's what I'm up to.
Right.
Here's something I was thinking about. And a lot of the work that I make, it definitely comes out of this, the images that I make in particular too, of this, you know, I say the underbelly of things, but just how like real life is totally abject and not slick and difficult all the time. And so I feel so much better in making images and speaking to people about, you know, like, listen, I have totally been there, or this sucks as well. And so I'm so much more interested in having those conversations with people and showing, like, you know, here I am living with my mom in my hometown in the middle of nowhere, and I'm still making it work, you know. So you can be scrappy too. Like, nothing matters. Like, it really doesn't at the end of shit and having fun, or, you know, trying really hard, or any of those things. And so that's what that's my long-winded explanation about Instagram and more or less why I do it.
Well, I also want to ask you, though, about sales. I assume that you've been approached by interested parties to buy your work through Instagram. And since you are represented, how does that scenario play out?
Yeah, a lot of things have happened just exclusively from Instagram. I get so many new followers to my work from there, and so I'm always, you know, a lot of people will just send me a direct message and just ask, you know, I'm interested in this, how do I pursue, and I just give them an email and send them to my gallery kind of thing. But there's been a lot of like group shows that I've been in just from people being like, you know, that I've never met. Just last week someone asked me to be in a group show, and it's up right now. And I just had a quick turnaround, and I made something and sent it off, and it's in a show right now in New York. And it's just like, that was literally from Instagram. Would have never happened if it wasn't for that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I was saying at the beginning that I can be in the middle of nowhere and still be, you know, I'm working really hard. I work pretty hard on Instagram in the sense of just maintaining a presence and, because really, if I didn't, it really would it would be a lot quieter. And so I feel like I've kind of stirred a lot up just from posting and having conversations. And there have been a lot of times, very often I'll just write to people and just be like, I love what you're doing. This is a big thing. And that kind of brings me back to a point that I kind of forgot, in the sense that, like when I was in New York, before I was using Instagram, or before anyone was really using Instagram as a tool, before I would go to an opening, I would be like, how do I talk to this person? What, you know, is there, what's the entry point for conversation? Did he go to a school that I know someone? Does he know someone? Or that kind of thing.
Right.
And so now it's so easy to make a connection in terms of, you know, professionally, like, you know, I can just be like, hey, I saw your painting from the other day. It looked great. Or, you know, in person or, you know, on a direct message or something like that. And it's easier than ever to make connection. It just blows my mind that I can have these conversations with people and still be doing this.
Yeah.
Where it was so much harder back in the day, pre Instagram. I mean, I don't even know. I just remember being so freaked out to go to an opening and like, who's the person that I talk to, or who's the artist, or what do they look like? And now it's just like, you bring it up, you check it out, and you know very intimately what these people are about, which I think is awesome.
But sometimes I'm
like, ooh, this is a little bit too, sometimes I feel a little too reliant on my phone, but it's because it's really the only thing that I have here.
Sure.
Like, truly.
Let me just interject for a second with on one hand, you were talking about, you know, the reality, sort of portraying and conveying the realities of how difficult it is to be an artist. And then now you're talking about Instagram and how easy it is, you know, connecting with these artists, which is sometimes true and obviously has been true for you. But I just want to briefly mention the other side, which is because I curated a show that's up now. And initially I started kind of roughly with a dream list of artists that I wanted to include, and there were a couple of people. There was one artist, let's say, that I reached out to on Facebook just to see if anybody knew this artist. And I think like a couple of years back, I had written to this artist, sort of asking a question or something to that effect, and never heard back. So all to say that I didn't try to reach out to this artist via Instagram, and maybe I should have, but I don't know if you've experienced that as well, but there are definitely some artists that you just cannot reach, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah, totally. For sure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess we've gotten a good sense of Instagram.
I'm such a proponent of it. I like when I talk to students, I'm always just saying, you know, you would be stupid not to use it in this day. And it's not necessarily that like everything you make has to be a masterpiece, but I mean, I use it in the sense of teaching, to be like, okay, here's literally every single person that you would ever want to see, or more or less, that's making art contemporarily. You know, if you love a particular gallery, you'd check out who they follow, you know, and you're like, okay, who's this person? Let me check them out.
Right.
And it's just that easy to be, not even just in terms of communication, but just to be aware of other people making work today, or having dialogues about anything, or sharing things. And that's more or less, you know, in the sense of being disciplined and being aware of good things and things that you're just like totally grossed out by. You know, most of the things, well, there's a lot of things I see on Instagram that I'm just like, oh Christ, this is the worst shit. And continuously, and maybe what you were saying about reaching out to people, it's just like, how is this person a thing? It's like a lot of just being aware of trends and what people are constantly being picked up for things, and, you know, just being hyper aware of how things are working, because you really do get a really intimate idea of, you know, who's going where and whose people's crews are and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think that people are just doing a disservice if they're not, you know, maybe even not participating, but just, you know, creeping and sponging, you know.
The thing I wanted to ask you is when you're feeding your gallery with collectors because they've approached you on Instagram, is there any kind of, my first instinct is to wonder if you have some kind of bonus from that, like, you know, are they going to give you a better percentage because you've referred a client to them? But then I'm just to play devil's advocate on their side, as you sort of characterize your situation, you know, being in the quote unquote in the middle of nowhere and, you know, having your phone be this major tool, is that sort of the flip side of it, that they're taking care of you even though you're not in the city, and so in exchange for that you're doing things like feeding them clients? Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I think that we're more or less symbiotic in the sense that, you know, she throws me some things and I throw her some things, and so it's really whoever is coming to these things. A lot of the people that I don't want to be shitty about it, but a lot of people that are some of my followers will reach out and think that like a jug is maybe $200 or something. And so, you know, they'll be like, oh, how do I get one of these things? And I'm like, well, you can, you know, go to my gallery and that kind of thing. And so there's probably more dead ends with sales, I would imagine. I don't know. I'd probably have to ask her, but the conversations that I've had have been a lot of misunderstanding as to, oh, a painting is, you know, it's not like $1,000, or it's not always cheap, or, you know, a jug is not it's a whole other thing. So, and I get a lot of like, do you have prints of these or that kind of stuff? And it's coming back to kind of the Robert Crumb thing. Like I'm really interested in having it be accessible to both high and low, or, you know, to be able to have things for people that love my work, but, you know, how can they participate in it? And so I'm really interested in thinking about things like that in the future, how it can be both and not just for this special 1% that gets to live with things for the rest of their lives, you know? So, cause I can't afford to buy work. I don't buy other people's work. I can't afford that. So, but I can afford a print. I can't afford, little things here and there. So I think about that in terms of,
well, for the moment, forward. is there any version of your work that's affordable for the lower end buyer or not yet?
Probably not. I mean, I do a lot of like little work on paper, like little scraps and, but the thing about that is that, and that's the best part of having a gallerist is that, in my opinion, is that, you know, she takes care of that. And I'm definitely aware of what's going on, but in terms of, you know, she knows how things are going. She knows the market. She knows who's buying things and what's going on. And so she is, you know, putting my price points and that kind of thing. And so at one point, you know, a cartoon might have been $200 a few, you know, years ago, but, you know, exponentially it has increased. So, but yeah, I would really like to do more prints, things that actually have my hand on it, like really cool editions and stuff like that. But I would like to do, just so, like I said, I'm really interested in both high and low and accessibility. But I haven't quite managed to bridge that. I'm still just like so behind in making actual work.
Right.
It's like, it's so hard. It takes forever for me to actually make things. And so it's a lot of time. Most of my time is just like ponying up, making actual shit.
Here's something that I want to ask that I think will bring it back around to, it will bring it back around to one of the things we were talking about earlier, not necessarily at the beginning, but it might be a good way to wrap up. And that is, how do you think you're being portrayed in your work, often bumpkin-like, or I don't know what kind of terms you use, but sort of sexualized character-like. How have those things been in the perception of your romantic interminglings, if at all?
That's not where I thought you were going to go with that, but I like it.
Good.
Well, there's a lot to talk. There's actually quite a lot to talk about in this sense. That if people are really doing their homework and due diligence, you know, so many times I get, and this is also going to make me seem like a ding dong, but people be like, why do you paint yourself so grotesque? And you're actually, you know, pretty more or less, you know, when I work on it. It's more so just it's just a diaristic depiction of it in the sense there's one that I did that I feel like is a example of it, which is me. It's called Cinnabon in Bed, and I'm eating this Cinnabon.
Oh,
and
yes. I saw that one. we'll post that with the episode so people know. Yeah.
What?
I said we'll post that with the episode so people can look at it as we're talking. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, please. I think that's a good culmination of kind of everything that I'm talking about.
Right.
But, you know, it's definitely, in a sense, that particular image, something actually happened. I got this gross Cinnabon on at like a rest stop on my way from New York, and I ate it in bed at like 4 a.m. and it was one of those things of like so grossed out by it and so completely thrilled, like, oh, this is the best thing, and also just like so grotesquely this is disgusting and you should be ashamed. And so it's always that like back and forth bad girl good girl thing.
Yeah.
Again, it comes back to like, okay, this is something that actually happened. This is real life shit, and I'm going to depict it because it feels more genuine to me than not. And so the roundabout way is that I guess that people really think one way or the other. With my more naturalistic drawings, I've had people say, like, oh, I just, you know, you're so voluptuous and, like, you know, those rolls and you're round and all that, like, almost fetishized kind of, you know, kind of, I don't even know how to articulate it. But there's definitely been conversations in terms of how I depict myself, in terms of you're so much prettier than what you depict yourself, but it's kind of how I, my everyday waking up and rolling over and making shit, that is my everyday. And that's how every, you know, it's just normal. It's just normal existing. But I definitely have, I'm really attracted to this idea of like wild women and people just doing whatever they want and completely mm-hmm. living off the grid. And that's where a lot of this kind of frenzied, mm-hmm. you know, hairy look comes from. And they're really comfortable with themselves, even though they look so hideous. And I say like diaristic in the sense, you know, when I was growing up, I had these huge caterpillar eyebrows and this thick mustache forever. And I don't know why I didn't fix it. I just was like, I didn't think about it at that age. And so it was always, and I was like brutalized for it. And it was one of those things, like I didn't even think about it. But, you know, so now what do? I paint them in all of my paintings because it's kind of like all this awkward shit that mm-hmm. defined me, or, and that it's kind of that all encompassing self-acceptance, which I think makes you like the most hardcore, powerful bitch ever. And so like, that's mm-hmm. what I'm more or less thinking.
Right.
And so the conversations in terms of like courtship, if that's even
sure,
or suitors, I think that they're aware. I think the most, more or less, people are intimidated by it. I don't think people really know what to make of it. Like, what is this? You know, it is kind of a weirdo, shocky thing, how I'm depicting things. But
yeah,
there's also like an image of, I don't know how this fits into my dating life perception. There's an image that I did, and it's a self-portrait, thinly veiled, with a pill on my tongue. And everyone thinks it's like ecstasy or whatever, but the title is Plan B on Easter Sunday, which is, again, something that actually happened, and like diaristically just like spewing it out in the world. And it's also kind of that, you know, bad girl, good girl kind of thing, back and forth exhaustively. So I don't know. I guess if you're interested in dating someone that paints a massive tangled bush, then I'm like your girl.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
Or or like, you know, people throwing up on themselves, like, right. I'm your girl for that.
Right.
So,
awesome. Basically. No, I guess, I mean, just to be really specific about it, and I hope I'm not alienating women listeners as far as like having a double standard, or would I ask this question, you know, of an R. Crumb like guest or what have you. But I'm just curious, you know, this is just case by case, that you make this very, you know, autobiographical, self-mocking, you know, et cetera type work. And I guess I just wonder, I imagine the scenario where you're on a date with a guy, you know, you're kind of into him, he's kind of into you. You know, and then at some point, and he's unaware that he maybe knows you're an artist, but he's unaware of your work. And then at some point during the date, after the date, whatever, he sees your work, you know. And so what happens to him in his head? Like, is he able to compartmentalize and go, wow, she's really good artist, you know, I'm still into her? Or is he looking at you romantically and kind of going, I don't know, you know, does he have to have a certain amount of kink in his vocabulary or what have you?
yeah. I mean, I don't care.
Okay, that's
don't
a great answer.
I don't care what this dude thinks.
That's a great answer.
Whatever I'm doing, more or less. But it does provide, like, interesting thoughts. The people, I'll come back to it romantically, but in the sense that it's always funny, the people's reactions to things, in the sense that the people that are always kind of, like, high... Well, let's take it... an example of my small hometown. There's kind of like a group of fancy or Sunday paintery people around here.
Sure.
And so if I would ever show them my work, and I have before, it's just like, oh my God, this is so, what is this? This, like, she is deranged. Who, and that's why I kind of keep it on the down low around
right.
here, because I think it's like a little too much. But at the same time, and I think that translates to the art world as well in some scenarios, but if I would show that, show a painting with, you know, a dude throwing up on himself, or me with a huge bush and like floppy boobs or something, if I would show that to like the tavern hero, like having a drink at the bar, like he always cracks up, loses his shit, you know, mm-hmm. and thinks it's the funniest thing ever. So it's always, you know, and those are my people. That's more
right.
or less the people that I gravitate towards.
Right.
You know, again, the high and the low, the liminal, the, mm-hmm. you know, fine art, and like, who cares at the end of the day? Like, you know, is it even, it's ridiculous that I'm even painting pictures of, you know, vomit, and it's on a gallery wall in New York City. Like, it's insane, like, to begin with. But most of the people that I've kind of, you know, rolled around with, they're really pumped that I'm like making these gross images. Like, they think that that's more or less like the response from romantic guys. They're really, really into the fact that I'm kind of like powerful, or that I'm just like self-accepting and just doing this weird shit.
Yeah.
And so more or less, that's kind of what I get. At the end of the day, I mean, if you can't hang with it, then
you have no patience for them.
Me.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Yeah, exactly. I'm just like, whatever.
Right.
No big deal. No loss.
Right. Right. All right. Well, I think we've gotten ourselves, among other things, a really good addition to your dating profile. Right. And in
so
addition
funny,
to that,
I've listened to some of these, you know, to quite a few of these before, and sometimes it comes up, sometimes it doesn't. And I'm like, I bet for sure. But I haven't really thought about as much how that plays into relationships. So mm-hmm. this has been interesting. I've really been like thinking on my toes a little bit.
That's the idea
in terms of that. But
yeah,
I knew that was coming up. But yeah, for sure. If you're listening.
Yeah.
And you like tiny
here? Ready?
Bush,
ready? Okay. Wait.
You like vomit.
Let's do an official lead up. Okay, and this will be our closer. We're gonna give you 25 seconds, right, where you're gonna introduce yourself, do whatever sort of description that you like, and then you know, that'll be our closer. How does that sound?
Oh, okay. Like dudes that I'm interested in, my type.
No. So in other words, you're gonna say hi. I'm Rebecca Morgan. I live in
yeah.
... Okay, so ready? Here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, Rebecca Morgan.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Morgan. I live in Clearfield, Pennsylvania currently. What else? Things like long walks on the beach, that kind of shit.
Sure, you can take it that way. You can say I'll be living in Cincinnati starting next September. You know, whatever.
Okay, I can do this. So I'll be living in Middle America, Ohio, Cincinnati to be specific. You don't have to be from Cincinnati. You can be from any which way, as long as you are passionate about something, anything. I don't care what it is. You have to be good to your mother. You have to be family oriented, or you have to be a kind person, a decent person, a reasonable human being. You have to, most importantly, be funny, or have some kind of, mm-hmm. Can deal with humor. You have to be articulate. I like smart people. I do really like going for car rides. I like doing a lot of nothing. I'm very passionate about that. I'm kind of a homebody. But yeah, it's kind of hard to find just a decent human without weird baggage.
Right.
And I have my own. We all have our baggage, but more or less, I like kind of doughier kind of
dudes.
the male equivalent of me, basically. I'm okay. So vain.
Okay, well, that disqualifies me then. Sorry. and I was going to say, if I could add one thing to it, and tell me if you want to add this as well. No ghosting.
Sure. No ghosting. God damn. That it's so scary that that's going to be like a normal thing it is a normal thing at this point, like that. Yeah. It's socially acceptable. Yeah. I've been ghosted. I have to admit, I've probably ghosted on some people myself. So, I'm definitely not perfect about it, but it is so brutal. I think all the time when I have a boyfriend, I'm like, okay, this is it. I'm good. I don't have to look anymore. And, you know, and then people change, things change, scenarios change, everything changes. But yeah, I'm always just like, ah, oh, I can finally stop. and now I'm like, ah, oh, I got to start looking again. And I don't want it to, I feel bad when it's kind of like a mission. And now I'm just kind of resigned to, is that how everyone says, when you're not looking,
yep,
you'll find it,
yep,
that kind of thing.
And exactly.
So now I'm just like, okay, let's just chill a little
right.
bit.
Right.
Yeah, I'm super excited to go to Cincinnati. You don't have to live in Cincinnati, but if you live anywhere else and you want to do long distance, you want
right.
to freaking come see me, who cares? I mean, whatever. Yeah, you do have to be able to cope with a strong-willed female, though. That's definitely something. Oh, you have to be a feminist. More
okay.
or less. You can't be a shitty.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you've had your fill of rednecks to last for a long time. You probably don't need any more, I presume.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. It's so funny that I'm all about using a platform for my personal,
absolutely.
Dating
absolutely.
Life.
And if I think of anybody, I will definitely, either make an introduction or at least inquire. So, yeah.
Well, they say that's what you have to do, that you have to tell people that you're looking. And so now I'm back in the game, I think.
Awesome.
So
yeah, you're making your intentions known. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to throw it out there. So, I mean, the other thing is I just don't get too worked up about anything. And obviously there's no holds barred. So I don't feel... I rarely feel embarrassed about anything that I do.
That's
so
healthy.
That's kind of where maybe what got me here, and hence why I'm playing Love Connection on this podcast.
Well, Rebecca, this has been great. Thank you so much for talking.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. I'm really happy to have this platform to talk. For
absolutely. Absolutely. And we're out. Okay, there you go. Thank you very much again to Rebecca for talking to me. And those of you interested in getting in touch with Rebecca, because she's got a great profile, definitely feel free to reach out to me. I will carefully screen your interest and then, if appropriate, pass that along to her. And if you know anybody who you think might be a good match, definitely let us know as well. Okay, let's make this matchmaking thing happen, shall we? That would be fun, wouldn't it? It'd be a fun thing to contribute to. So thanks again to Rebecca. And I hope you, Rebecca Morgan, Instagram fans, got to make it all the way through to this episode. Let's see. So just a couple of things before we get to the Robert Rauschenberg spiel. Want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. This show is done for free by myself and Kate Mitchell, who helps very much with the screening for the show. And it takes a lot of time. It takes a certain amount of money as well. And so your donations are the only way that this show keeps afloat financially. We do not have advertising, as you have noticed for the moment. So best way to support the show financially is to become an ongoing contributor via Patreon. You can donate there for as little as $1 a month. Though if you start at $3 or more a month, you'll be eligible for the bonus episodes and more. PayPal, starting at $25 or more a month, one-time donation rather. And other ways you can support the show, you can leave a great review on iTunes, which is linked through the website. It will help other people find this podcast. You can follow the show on social media at Artist Podcast, and you can become a fan on Facebook. By the way, I was talking with an artist who was over at my studio recently about this, who got off of Facebook in the wake of the election. I'm still on it. I haven't gotten off, but I have noticed that since I've basically only been posting updates of the podcast that not many people seem to care. I'm just wondering if any of you guys have had that experience, if you're sort of still on Facebook, but you don't really participate. So those of you who are missing me or are pissed at me because I don't participate, I am very sorry. Feel free to reach out to me via email, phone call, what have you, no problem if you want to get in touch in real time. How else? Yeah, I think that about covers it as far as the ways you can support the show. Thank you very much in advance. So before we go, I know there's a lot of various art news going on as always, but there is a Rauschenberg retrospective at MoMA right now. And this is an article called The Wave of History that my favorite art writer, Peter Sheldahl, recently wrote in The New Yorker. And something stuck out to me that he wrote that I wanted to share with you, and it is, he writes, Rauschenberg's work in mediums that range from painting and photography to a big vat of bubbling gray mud muse from 68 to 71, is uneven, and it lost pertinence and drama in his later decades. For a great artist, he made remarkably little good art. But the example of his nimble intelligence and zestful audacity affected the sense of vocation, thoughts and motives, doubts and dreams of subsequent generations to this day. And I'll just say a couple quick things about that. One is, I remember as a young art student slash artist being particularly taken with his range, and from the monochrome, from the white and black paintings, to Monograph, or the one with the goat and the tire, and so on. Just the audacity and the range. Erase de Kooning, of course. And then one other point is that in the Conversation Three-Way, Episode 2, Part 2, which was with artist Robin O'Neill and curator at the Broad, Ed Shad, we talked about artists who we loved and artists who we hated or thought were, I think we talked about artists who were overrated and artists who were underrated, and I had as my overrated Robert Rauschenberg, which Ed and I quibbled with about briefly. And Peter Sheldahl, I think, articulated exactly why. Because when you see his work, when I've seen his work in the last, 10 years or so, it feels so kind of academic, I guess, to me. It's just not fun to look at, let's put it that way. And the charge of progressivism, of the avant-garde that he had back in the day, or when I was a young artist, has kind of been lost. So that's just my two cents on Rauschenberg. I'd love to know what your thoughts are, if you can relate or you totally disagree. Okay, so it's going to be another couple weeks, it looks like, but I hope you got a lot out of the Rebecca Morgan conversation, and again, that you will employ your network to provide good dating candidates that I can pass along. Thank you very much in advance. Thank you for listening to the episode. Thank you for supporting the show in one way or another. And I wish you a good couple of weeks. Ciao for now.